What's up, guys, and welcome to The Fiction Fix, a Screen Junkie's guide to everything, your one-stop shop for film, TV, and everything in between. I'm Ben Chappell, and I'm going to be your host for today. Unfortunately, Rohan and Martin are unavailable due to their supremely ill conditions at the moment. However, we do wish them a speedy recovery, and we hope that they can be up on their feet and ready to go for 2015. This will be the last podcast for 2014, so I hope you guys had a really fun Christmas and you guys are looking forward to New Year's. It's only a few days now, I guess. I myself spent Christmas almost entirely eating chocolate, watching Die Hard, and listening to Chet Faker. But I mean, can you really judge me for that? I mean, Chet Faker, great music. Die Hard, classic Christmas film, probably the best of all time. And chocolate really just rounds out the entire experience, I feel. There's been a lot of news recently, especially with this whole Sony hacking scandal. I mean, Rohan and I talked a lot about it in the... A lot about the Sony hacking scandal in particular, but we talked a lot about Marvel being talked with Sony for Spider-Man in our last podcast, episode 13. If you haven't checked that out, go check that out. And I guess ever since we recorded that podcast, all this information has surfaced where they have actually been in talks. So it's really interesting to see that what we speculated on has actually come to fruition and that they are currently in talks. I mean, I suppose it was expected Marvel and Sony would be in talks with Spider-Man. You'd be kind of foolish not to think that. However, the fact that they're actually confirmed right now, it makes a Marvel fan like me really excited to see what's actually going to happen in the future. But if you want to hear more about that, go to episode 13 of our Marvel and DC discussion. In the meantime, however, this podcast is going to be entirely dedicated to, firstly, two movie reviews with The Hobbit: Battle of the Five Armies, which I saw on opening day, and that was a fun experience. And also, The Interview, which is the real center for a lot of this Sony hacking scandal stuff in the media. Because North Korea, as we know, has had a lot of issues with The Interview being released. As many people know, The Interview is starring Seth Rogen and James Franco, where they go to kill Kim Jong-un, or assassinate Kim Jong-un, I should say. And obviously, the Sony hacking scandal saw a lot of emails and a lot of threats leaked from North Korea themselves to Sony to cause some 9/11 style attacks should they release the film. So they limited the release to online only and a few very, very restricted releases in small-time cinemas that were still, you know, ballsy enough to actually release it. And they made around 2.8 mil, I think, from the box office, but they made like 20 million in the first weekend or something first weekend for their online releases, which is like a record or something. So that's phenomenal. The second half of the podcast, however, we will be going through our top 10 and bottom 10 films of 2014. I'll be going through my own, of course, and Rohan have sent in their own top 10 lists so that we can listen to them as well, and so you can have a bit of a breakup from my voice. Unfortunately, if you're not a big fan of my voice for the next half an hour to an hour, I suppose, you're going to have a bad time. I suppose if you want to stick through it, listen to a couple of reviews, listen to what we think were the top 10 and worst 10 films of 2014, then fantastic. I hope you can stay with me and I hope we're going to have a lot of fun. The first film we're going to talk about today is what I just mentioned, The Interview, featuring Seth Rogen and James Franco, in which they try to go to assassinate Kim Jong-un. James Franco plays a kind of foolhardy interviewer, and Seth Rogen plays his producer. And together they have this amazing chemistry. All of a sudden, it turns out, Kim Jong-un is a really big fan of James Franco's show, Skylark. And so when Kim Jong-un invites Skylark, aka James Franco, and Seth Rogen over to North Korea in order to have this one-on-one exclusive interview, James Franco and Seth Rogen are approached by the CIA to assassinate Kim Jong-un, to take that opportunity to take out one of the world's most notorious leaders. And as such, loads of comedy ensues, as would be expected from a Seth Rogen and James Franco film. A lot of kind of lowbrow humor, but a lot of like really witty humor as well. And it's a fun time, to say the least. I had a lot of doubts about this film going into it, especially with this whole Sony hacking scandal. I did purchase it online, so it wasn't released in cinemas yet. And I feel like, I don't know, my personal opinion on this whole scandal is a bit uncertain, I suppose, because like I understand why they didn't release it, but at the same time, I feel like a government or a country such as the US should have been able to have the power to stand up to threats like that, and it really just makes the people who did threaten Sony kind of feel a bit more empowered. The fact that they can just make simple threats and simple demands, and they'll get them met because they make those threats just by words. And it really it concerns me, the fact that they have that much power over people like Sony and the government. But at the same time, I do understand that they've been through this sort of thing before. I mean, in Sydney especially, we just had a full hostage situation in Martin Place a couple of weeks ago. And that's terrifying for me and for the people who were there. And it's upsetting to see people collapse to that sort of pressure. But at the same time, I completely understand that we want to avoid casualties at all costs. Anyway, the film itself was actually a lot better than I expected. I figured that it was going to be, you know, classic weed jokes and classic, you know, sex jokes, that sort of thing. And there was a bit of that, but at the same time, it was just a really fun movie to watch. The acting was pretty funny. The way, I don't know who it is that actually acted as Kim Jong-un. I believe it was Randall Park, who I've seen in a couple of YouTube miniseries and I've seen in a couple of films already. He's not really a high-end name. However, with his performance here, he's shown himself to be a really capable comedic actor. And I really had a lot of fun with his role and the way the chemistry worked between the characters. And yes, there are a lot of jokes that kind of get a little stale over time. As with any Seth Rogen, James Franco film, like Pineapple Express, there are, you know, gems amidst the rough. But however, there are, you know, those, the ones that are said once and it's funny, and then it's said again and it's a little less funny, and then it's repeated and repeated, and it gets a little old by the end of the film. However, there were twists and turns that the film took that were kind of predictable, but at the same time just really gave the film a little bit more charm. And it was, I don't know whether I want to like it because of this whole Sony hacking scandal, whether I want to like it just to rub it in the face of North Koreans, or whether I did genuinely enjoy it, but it was a film that I had a good time with and that I don't regret purchasing. Obviously, the chemistry between the two main characters, as always, was just impeccable, and the two worked so well together. And it made great commentary on the whole political dialogue between the two nations, US and North Korea, while at the same time stereotyping them in a, yes, hilarious way, but also a kind of a cringeworthy way. And at times you get a little bit uncomfortable with it all, but it's a discomfort that they intend to employ in the same way that, like, Team America intended to employ. But I highly recommend seeing the film, if not just to understand what it is exactly that North Korea was opposed against. But it was just a good time. So if I had to give it a rating out of 5, The Interview will probably receive a 3.7. And I don't know whether that's because, I don't know, I just want to stand up against authority or whatever, or whether I just did genuinely enjoy the movie. I might look back at it in a year's time and when all of it's blown over and realize, hey, it's actually not a great film. But in the moment, I actually did have a good time. The second film that we're going to talk about today is Peter Jackson's highly anticipated final installment of the Hobbit trilogy. It's the final film that we're going to see in Middle-earth, as far as we're aware. I mean, there's no more material that we can really go off. So unless they do an original series, this is really it. This is the last we're going to see in Middle-earth. And it's The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. Now, this film, first and foremost, is the climax of the series, where you have this big battle. And there really was just a build-up with the first two. And then this final installment really was just the final battle, where everything is accumulated and everything is culminated to this one big scene. And it really is just constituted by one big battle, essentially, which I guess is pretty obvious given the title. However, it really opened up with, and no spoilers, obviously, it opened up with Smaug burning the town that Bard lived in. I can't remember the name of it, who really cares, Lake Town or something. And as we saw from, like, the end of the second film, he's setting it on fire, whatnot. And that really only lasted a couple of minutes. And I'm surprised, because Smaug was set up to be this huge character in the second film, I should say. And then all of a sudden, like, he just, I don't know, they didn't really treat him as well as I thought they should. They didn't give him as much gravitas as they did in the second film. And it was disappointing to see that happen, because that scene was only there for, like, 15 minutes max, maybe 10 minutes, I don't know. But it wasn't going on for very long at all. Then they really jump into this whole battle thing, and it's really not very well explained. And it really is just the dwarves trying to fortify this mountain of gold that they've received, that they've claimed, against the elves who have come to take back what they deserve. The people of Lake Town, who believe that they are owed a share of the gold because of the agreement that they made with the dwarves in helping them. And then there are also orcs, and there are goblins that are all coming down to attack them and to take over or whatnot. You know, essentially just big battles between five armies. I suppose the title could not get more descriptive of the plot than that. And a lot of the conflicts, I feel, were a little bit forced. I mean, I read the book, and I don't know, I feel a lot of the conflicts in the movie just deviated from the book in a very shallow way. And I couldn't really understand what would substantiate a big battle like this between all these different armies and all these different sides, and why they would oppose certain other sides, why they would agree to become allies with other sides. I didn't understand their motives behind it all. They didn't really have them very well explained, apart from, you know, very shallow, I want this gold, I want these jewels, and it's not very well done. I believe that plot could have been fleshed out a bit more. What was really disappointing, however, was the characterization of Thorin, played by, I think, Richard Armitage, who is the Dwarf King, essentially, trying to regain, or reclaim, I should say, his throne with the Arkenstone and with all his gold, and he's looking for the stone and becomes a bit... He's infected with what is called a dragon sickness, which, I mean, you can't really get more descriptive than that, can you? And I suppose I was disappointed in the way they just kind of undermined him from the get-go. There was no build-up, there was no sort of deterioration in his psyche. It was just, bam, he has gone from A to B. He has gone from this person to this person without any sort of explanation at all, except for dragon sickness. And this isn't a spoiler or anything, so don't worry. It's pretty obvious given the trailers and whatnot. However, I just felt like they kind of undermined his character a little bit, and it really did feel like two different movies, essentially, because the first two-thirds of the film was just a whole load of people saying things and people claiming things, people throwing accusations and then fighting for no reason, and there was an awkward mixture of comedy and also drama, a mixture of comedy and action, I should say, that didn't really mesh well, especially given the fact that the first Hobbit and the second Hobbit kind of did it pretty well, especially the second Hobbit. I really enjoyed Desolation of Smaug. And it's really disappointing to see how they didn't translate the similar dichotomy between comedy and action that they did in the second one. Another thing that I will say is that the dwarves, I still don't really care for about three quarters of them. They only gave a few of them really good lines, and I only cared about two or three of them in the end. I mean, they put a lot of them in the background, and that's the danger of having so many dwarves in the film, is that you'll never be able to relate to all of them. But I expected to relate to a whole lot more than just two or three. I mean, but that's where I mean that the film really divides into two films. There's that awkward kind of trying to do comedy, trying to do action, trying to do political conflict, and then there's the ending. All right, the ending is very different. The last act is really, really good, where you have the standoff between Thorin Oakenshield and Bilbo and a few others against the mighty orcs. And what is done there is really, really good. Just the mixture of cinematography, of great music, and just really well done camera shots around the characters, especially to show this despair, to show this, just these characters who have copped so much anguish and grief, and now they're in the middle of this face-off, and it's just traumatizing for them. However, and that's what you really feel for them, and these characters that they've selected from the big group of dwarves, you really start to feel for in the last act. And I feel like there were very different films there. One thing I will say, however, is that this 48 frames per second thing, I still don't really understand, because I was sitting there watching the film, and as the camera panned across this incredible scenery, I mean, New Zealand has some just mind-blowing landscapes, and they really utilize that in this film. And Peter Jackson is well-renowned for using them, for using his settings really, really to its fullest extent. But I just feel like the 48 frames per second really undermine that, because as the camera panned across this incredible mountain setting, it took a long time for your eyes to just catch up with it, because it would kind of go out of focus and kind of your mind took a while to catch up with what the camera was showing. And I just don't think that 48 frames per second in that just gigantuan portrayal of mountains and settings and landscapes, it can't be well received by audiences, because we're just not trained. Our eyes haven't been modified or modulated in a way that we can understand what is being shown to us, and that we can receive it, and our eyes can like break it down and then build it back up in this quick enough time that they want us to, or that we can in 24 frames per second, for example. And it's just a kind of evolutionary thing that I think we might have to get used to, but at the moment it's just difficult for our brains and for our eyes to catch up with what the 48 frames per second is showing us. And there's this bit of lag there and misfocus. And I don't know, I personally wasn't a big fan of it, but maybe it's just because we're not used to it yet. And I think that's something that could develop later on in the future and could become just really big. And this could be a milestone, The Hobbit, for being a pioneer for 48 frames per second. And look, it very well could be, but at the moment we're just not at that stage yet. But for the most part, the graphics were pretty decent. I wouldn't say that the effects were as good as the second film at all, especially the effects on the dwarves and the orcs. However, it was very, very good. The music, as always, was phenomenal. The acting was also not too bad, but I mean, they don't really rely on the acting too much. The film itself was a great film. I had a lot of fun with it. Did feel like two different films. I would not say that it was better than the second film of The Hobbit. However, I would say that it is probably better than The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. So it probably rests somewhere in between. And that final scene when Bilbo goes home, no spoilers, just it hits you where you live, man. It just, for a fan of the original series and like a fan of Middle Earth as a whole, it just, it's something that really lands home for you. It's a great ending to what has been a phenomenal franchise. So thank you to Peter Jackson for bringing The Hobbit back and for bringing Middle Earth back. And thank you for bringing us along for the ride. Really, it has been an incredible experience. And maybe one day we'll see you again in the future, but it just doesn't seem likely. As for a score, I'm going to give The Hobbit Battle of the Five Armies a 4.0 out of 5. As you guys can probably tell, this podcast is going to be a little bit short, especially since it's just me talking. I'm going to have a little bit of a break now. My voice is killing me. However, I will be back very soon to discuss my top 10 favorite and least favorite films of 2014.
It's not a bird, don't replay. It's Fred Campbell.
Police and police, like a better built gang, handcuffing authority to integrity by the waist. Nah, not for long till the next call, cause folks still think bullets are in the name of God. It's no loss for crushed menthol, shadow boxing the smoke, throwing jabs at a brick wall for fun, to entertain the inevitable when the night falls and what shadows to dust. I work between the law and the dirt, technically the same.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is time. That time of year where you choose which is your favorite and which are your least favorite films of 2014. This year has been an incredible year. I mean, while 2014 has had some absolute stinkers, there have been some really incredible gems. 2014 has really been big for comic books, for superheroes, but also for just cinematography in general. I mean, you've got Interstellar for one, and you've got X-Men Days of Future Past and all that sort of, all those films that really just encompass what 2014 is about. Marvel and DC have made really big headlines this year with all their casting choices, with all their release dates, and it's been a really massive year for comic book fans especially. It's been a really fun year watching all these films, seeing a lot of them grow and evolve, seeing a lot of actors who you've not seen previously, or who you have seen and you haven't been particularly impressed by, and you've seen them in films in 2014 and they've really blown your mind. For example, I haven't seen this film yet and I really regret it, because guaranteed it would probably be on my top 10 list. But Whiplash has had some incredible reviews, and it sounds like just an amazing movie that I would personally be a massive fan of. So I'm going to go out and buy that as soon as it comes out on DVD. But at the moment, it doesn't feature on my top 10 list, purely because I haven't seen it yet, but I have high hopes for it. I hear Miles Teller in that film is just outstanding, and J.K. Simmons as well, who has really been in the background for a bit, or who many recognize as the voice of Tenzin, Legend of Korra, which also ended a couple of weeks ago. Fantastic ending, just saying. I hear Whiplash is incredible and that there are actors in that that just blow your mind. Other films that I haven't seen, because it hasn't been released in Australia yet, and that other people would put on their 2014 top 10 films list, include Birdman,
which is not being released until January 15, which I find just a bit weird. We've got The Imitation Game, which comes out just in a few days, January 1. So I'm going to see that as soon as it comes out, with Benedict Cumberbatch. The Theory of Everything, which is the Stephen Hawking biopic, comes out on January 29, which is weirdly late, I feel. That's way too close to the Oscars for us. I mean, it's already been released in the US. It's odd to me that it's waiting until the end of January to come out in Australia. And then I'm hearing really good things about American Sniper with Bradley Cooper. However, that doesn't come out until January 22 in Australia. So unfortunately, those films cannot make the list, even though it is highly likely, based on the reviews, that they could have made the list. Remembering what I told you before, that this list is entirely opinionated, the top 10 and bottom 10 lists of 2014, for me personally, are my own personal opinion. You guys are perfectly entitled to have your own opinions, and guaranteed, probably no one will have the same list as I do, and that's fine. It's just what we do, it's what critics do. Movie criticism, movie reviews are always just opinionated. A lot of people get really, really angry and weirdly aggravated over how people rate movies. But you got to remember that movies are just an art. Movies are those types of things that are incredibly personal and incredibly individual as to how you receive it. And people take it. People take films differently. You know, people take different messages from films. People appreciate different things, and it's just. That's the amazing part of film, is that it's all subjective, it's all relative, and that's why I personally love film, because it's an art form. It's not a formula, it's not a mathematic equation, it's art, and that's what makes it so fun. It's because they're not all the same, and there's no one true formula to a movie. I think we'll start off by listening to Rohan's top 10 and bottom 10 lists, and see what they have to think about 2014 as a whole, because it really has been just a full-on year, and it shows that we have a lot to look forward to in the cinematic universe. I mean, we got 2015, we got a lot of movies to look forward to, we got Ant-Man, Avengers Age of Ultron, we've got a whole lot of different things, that's just Marvel, mind you. We've got, you know, Mad Max, Fury Road, we've got a whole load of different things that are coming out, and it's just really exciting, 2015. And I, as a movie critic and as just a movie fan, am really, really excited to watch these films, to appreciate them, to just envelop myself in these worlds and to give you guys my opinions, because podcasting and recording and reviewing is just something that we all love and we all really want to keep doing for you guys. As well as for ourselves. It's just something amazing. So we'll listen to Rohan's top 10 list and bottom 10 list, and then we'll come back to mine.
Hey guys, it's Rohan here with my top 10 and bottom 10 best and worst films of 2014. I couldn't make it earlier because of weird health issues and I was in the hospital and yeah, fun times. But I'm here with my top 10 and bottom 6, because I don't actually have that many movies that I disliked from this year. But let's get started. So one of my top favorite movies of this year was The Lego Movie, which I really, really enjoyed. I was told that I wasn't going to enjoy it by my friends, who told me that it was not great. But I ended up watching it and really, really liked it. The movie had some really good performances by Chris Pratt, who I really, really liked from Parks and Recreations. That's one of my favorite shows, and if anybody ever wants to watch it, you should go watch it. But Chris Pratt played a really good portrayal of the main character. Emmett, I think, was his name. And also, it had some really good portrayal by Will Ferrell and Elizabeth Banks and Will Arnett and Nick Offerman and Alison Brie and just Morgan Freeman, a whole heap of people. It was a star-studded cast, which kind of made me a little bit apprehensive about the movie. But once I went and saw it, I saw it had a really good message, an incredibly catchy song, and something for both adults and children, which I absolutely loved. Another movie that I really liked this year is a movie that we ended up going to see the premiere of back in February, and it's a movie called The Wind Rises, which is Hayao Miyazaki's final and most recent film that he's done in Studio Ghibli. The film pretty much focused on the protagonist, Jiro, who was an engineer who made planes during, I think it was World War II. The movie was really, really beautiful to watch on screen. We went and saw the premiere of the Japanese version in Newtown in February, and it was absolutely amazing to be surrounded by so many Ghibli fans and to watch this, you know, masterpiece of a movie where it was Miyazaki's last film, where Miyazaki is such a prolific director of you know, anime films, winning Best Animated Feature in 2002 for Spirited Away. And, you know, it was nice to see him collaborate with Joe Hisaishi again on the soundtrack, which was absolutely awesome. Ghibli soundtracks with Joe Hisaishi are always amazing. And so you know, The Wind Rises was absolutely no exception. What really cinched it for me with this movie was just the characterization was absolutely outstanding, and there were some amazing one-liners. The movie ended up being some sort of metaphor for Miyazaki's time making movies and being a director. You know, he was this guy who, you know, pretty much founded an animation company and did a whole lot of stuff with his life, and all of a sudden he became one of the most successful people in international cinema. And so the movie was really all about, you know, following your dreams and doing something big with your life. And I think that we can take a lot from this movie as a whole. I really, really like The Wind Rises, and I was really happy to go to the premiere, and, you know, I've still got the poster sitting on my wall, and that's why it's, you know, got a place in my top 10 movies of this year. The next movie I liked was just absolutely outstanding, and I didn't expect anything less from one of my favorite directors, although people are always polarized by him, and that was Wes Anderson's brand new movie, Grand Budapest Hotel. This was a movie that I'd been looking forward to for over a year. I remember finding out about it in 2013, which was, I think, about a year after Moonrise Kingdom came out, which is his second most recent film. And Moonrise Kingdom was one of those films that, you know, it really enthralled me. I'd seen Wes Anderson stuff before, but Moonrise Kingdom just absolutely enamored me. And so I had really high expectations. Grand Budapest Hotel was a movie that, from its trailer, looked like it was going to emulate a whole lot of the directorial, directions that Moonrise Kingdom took, with Wes Anderson's very typical quirky panning shots and his overuse of symmetry. And so Grand Budapest Hotel definitely delivered on that front. It was quirky as anything, but it was one of the more accessible Wes Anderson films. Wes Anderson has done a lot of movies that have been a little bit jarring, and I know Moonrise Kingdom was definitely a movie that a lot of people didn't like purely because of the fact that it was so weird. But Grand Budapest Hotel is a movie that got a whole lot more favorable reviews than Moonrise Kingdom, and I think the amount of people that I've talked to about this movie who liked it is far greater than the amount of people who disliked it. The movie had some really good actors in it. It had some really good characterization. Ralph Fiennes did an amazing job as the main character, and this movie would not have been the same without him. Wes Anderson, of course, employed a whole lot of brilliant visual techniques and directorial techniques. And I think that this movie, combined with its soundtrack, combined with its, you know, quirkiness and uniqueness, made it one of my favorite movies of 2014. And really, I have come to expect that much of Wes Anderson. He's just such a great director and such an amazing guy. And everything he does with his movies is unique and it's different. And I know a lot of people say that he's different for different sake, but for me, it's something that I really, really enjoy. It's something that I love seeing in film. And I like seeing something quirky and something different. It's, you know, something that I really, really like. And in the same way that Alfred Hitchcock did some interesting things back in the 40s, 50s and 60s, I feel like Wes Anderson is kind of taking creative steps in the right direction. I think that that's really good. And I absolutely loved Grand Budapest Hotel. And I reckon that everybody should go see it. On a far lighter, a funnier note, another movie that I really liked this year that is kind of unexpected for me to put in a top 10 for, like, best movies of 2014, but I actually really, really enjoyed this, and I watched this movie again the other day, twice, actually, within the past week, with different people, and I found it as funny the second time and third time watching it that I did the first time watching it, and that's the movie The Other Woman. For anybody who doesn't know, The Other Woman is a typical kind of rom-com, almost chick flick, about, three women who find out that they've been dating the same man and that he's cheating on all of them, and they come together and find a way to get back at him. So the movie stars Cameron Diaz, Kate Upton, Leslie Mann, and surprisingly enough, Jamie Lannister from Game of Thrones, Nikolai Coster-Waldau, and the movie was absolutely hilarious. Now, in terms of, like, things that that people look for in movies, you know, if you are looking at this movie through the eyes of the Bechdel test, you're probably not going to go too far with it. I don't think the three female characters, who are all, like, white and blonde, you know, they're all talking about this one man, and they do, you know, it's very similar to the movie from 1996, First Wives Club, which starred Bette Midler and Diane Keaton. But, you know, I really liked it. It was a great thing. And even, the movie even starred Nicki Minaj, which is so weird because you wouldn't think that a good movie would be associated with Nicki Minaj, who recently came up with Anaconda. But the movie is absolutely hilarious. There were some amazingly funny moments and some very, you know, sassy, typical Cameron Diaz things. And I absolutely loved it. I absolutely adored this movie. I laughed so hard in the cinema that people started looking at me when I saw this back. I think it was in April or March. And, you know, Nikolai Coster-Waldau was hilarious. Leslie Mann was absolutely amazing. Leslie Mann is, you know, has comedic timing, but she was so funny in this movie. And even Cameron Diaz, who is a very, you know, a veteran rom-com actress, was absolutely outstanding in this. She wasn't terrible. All of their characters were quite relatable, apart from maybe Kate Upton, who was a little bit ditzy in this movie. But honestly, I really enjoyed this. It's a rom-com, yes, but it was an enjoyable rom-com. And I thoroughly recommend it to anybody who wants to see a movie where you can just chill out, turn off your brain and watch it and just laugh. So another movie that I really enjoyed that goes in my top 10 favorite movies of 2014 this year is also on a lighter note. And it's a movie that people might not think that I'm going to say. And that's X-Men Days of Future Past. Now, I'm a massive, massive comic book nerd and superhero movie junkie. But I've got to say, I wasn't particularly impressed by the most recent X-Men movies, especially X-Men Wolverine Origins. That movie honestly made me want to claw my eyes out, pun intended. X-Men First Class was a step in the right direction, but X-Men Days of Future Past came out this year, and it was absolutely amazing. I went and saw it with a whole heap of people, and, you know, some of them didn't even like superhero movies, and we watched it, and they all agreed that it was absolutely outstanding. There were some great performances in that movie by Ian McKellen and Jennifer Lawrence. And even Evan Peters made a surprise appearance, which was great as an American Horror Story fan. And that was absolutely so much fun. I really, really enjoyed watching that movie. Superhero movies are always a nice break from the, you know, the unyielding ethos of fine cinema, I guess. And it's sometimes really, really nice to just be able to go and see a movie that you can kind of chill out with and just enjoy. And in terms of action movies, as far as action movies go, I think that X-Men Days of Future Past was probably one of the best. Action and sci-fi, that is. And so I really enjoyed this and I thoroughly, thoroughly recommend it. The score was fantastic. Peter Dinklage was amazing in this movie. We know that he's outstanding from Game of Thrones, but let's be honest. I mean, Peter Dinklage in any role is going to be great. He absolutely killed this role. He slayed it. God. And yeah, so I really, really enjoyed X-Men Days of Future Past and I thoroughly recommend it to anybody who wants to see it. The next movie before I go into my more serious top 10 best picks of 2014 is another movie that requires little to no thinking. It was stupid and, you know, idiotic and I absolutely loved it. And this could possibly be just the situation that I saw it in where I was really tired and I went to the movies and it was outstanding. But that's 22 Jump Street. 21 Jump Street was one of my favorite movies of 2012, I think it came out in, or 2011. And I remember going to see it in the cinemas and absolutely like pissing myself with laughter. And 22 Jump Street was no exception. It was very self-aware. They made a whole lot of jokes to the fact that it was a sequel and that it was really not going anywhere. But I think that performances from Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill and Ice Cube, they really just did it for me. And this movie was absolutely hilarious. I really, really enjoyed it. And it's another movie where you can just kind of switch off and go and just laugh. You don't have to think about it. And I think that that's really important. Sometimes we get caught up in the fact that films have to be, you know, dramatic and they have to have amazing acting and they have to have, you know, fantastic scripts. But sometimes, you know, in the modern age of cinema, we need to take a step back and kind of acknowledge the fact that these indulgent commercial movies sometimes have, you know, redeeming qualities about them. And I think the 22 Jump Street is a really good example of that. It's a good example of the way in which, like, commercial films that kind of pander to the audience can actually get it right once in a while. And 22 Jump Street was definitely one of those films. Getting into my more serious picks, the next movie is a movie that I absolutely adored. It is an Irish movie, and it was a movie that I absolutely loved. And it's a movie called Calvary. And I don't think I talked about this too much in any of our podcasts this year. I think I ended up seeing it during a period of time when we weren't recording. But I'll be completely honest with you. This is probably one of the best movies that I've seen this year. Calvary follows the journey of an Irish priest. It's an Irish movie. Who is told in confession one day, in typical Catholic Irish anonymous confession, that this person, the confessee, is going to kill him in 7 days. And it focuses on his journey from... Sounds a little bit like The Ring, doesn't it? It focuses on his journey from when he started in that confession to the day that he confronts this person. And I think that this movie is it's very dramatic. It's very intense. It is a very serious movie, and it's definitely one of the finer films that they made this year. Calvary was one of those movies that you need to be prepared to be on the edge of your seat the whole way through. And not in a way like Argo or any of those, you know, Die Hard or any of those action movies, because Calvary is definitely not an action movie. Calvary is a movie that is an introspection. It's a very close look at the way that people function when they're put under pressure. And this priest, who has done a whole lot of things with his life, he has a very deep backstory, very, you know, great characterization there. It looks at the way in which this very complicated person, who we can all relate to as complicated people, deals with this idea of his own mortality, of the place of humanity within the world and the place of religion within that spectrum. And I think that this is a really good way for us to kind of figure out things about ourselves and about our place within the universe, as well as just the way the inherent complexity of human identity, the way in which human identity is just always going to be inherently complex. And I think that that's something that we can all kind of gain. And so Calvary is a really good movie for anybody who's kind of looking for something deep and introspective and a little bit meta, and I think that Calvary is a very, very great, very good movie. The next movie that I've got, and this is, I guess, number 7, is a movie that we reviewed very recently and that I have now seen 3 times, starring Ben Affleck as the illustrious main character. We have, and Rosamund Pike as the illustrious female lead character. Nick and Amy Dunn, we have Gone Girl. Now, Gone Girl is one of those movies that I absolutely adored. I ended up reading... Well, I tried to read the book. I read half of the book before I got into the movie because I just had no time, and then I was frantically trying to get through it before on our way to the cinema. But I really love Gone Girl, and I know that we've said this in our podcast. I think Ben and I both agreed that we absolutely adored this movie. But, you know, Gone Girl was one of the cinematic hits of 2014. And, you know, this list isn't in any order. Otherwise, I think that Gone Girl, and in any rate, Gone Girl would be right up the top there. Because this movie just surprised me. The plot of the movie, having read half of the book before I saw the movie, the plot of the movie was very, it was great. It was amazing. It was just impressive in general. But I've got to say that the movie adaptation definitely did what I had read in the book justice. And I think that it did the story justice, even though it missed out on, you know, various minor bits and pieces. What the movie is primarily concerned with and what the story is primarily concerned with is the way in which people treat relationships, the way in which people treat themselves, and the ways in which people treat other people. You know, talking about relationships, you know, relationship with yourself and relationship with your significant other, with your friends, with your family. And I think that this movie can teach us a whole lot of stuff about what you really know about people. Sometimes it's really important to kind of remember that you don't ever know anybody completely apart from yourself. And that's something that this movie instills in you. It instills this fear, you know, that you don't actually know everybody in as much as you know themselves. I remember I have a very keen memory walking out of the cinema once I'd finished the movie and just thinking, you know, talking to a friend of mine, and, you know, we were talking about, you know, the movie, and she said to me, like, doesn't this movie freak you out that you don't, you know, doesn't it make you realize that you don't know anybody as well as you think you do? And I kind of thought about it for a little bit and went, nah, that's stupid. This movie was fiction. And then I realized why this movie is so effective. Gone Girl is so effective because of the fact that it plays on this deep down primal subconscious fear that everybody has of the fact that they are different and the fact that other people will think and act differently to them. And that's something that is incredibly effective. And that's one of the reasons that Gone Girl really does it for me. Apart from the fact that Rosamund Pike's acting is insanely good and that she is absolutely amazing, and just Rosamund Pike is just an absolutely insanely amazing human being. But I think that this movie did a whole lot more for me in terms of the themes that the story drew upon. Apart from that, David Fincher did a fantastic job directing this movie. In typical David Fincher style, using a lot of kind of nighttime, a lot of black, and some just really, really effective establishing shots that I thought really did a lot for this movie. Some great tracking shots that were just, you know, amazing. And so I think that Gone Girl is one of those movies that we should really keep an eye out on. Because it's me, and this wouldn't be a best pick of 2014 list without a horror movie, I had to throw one in here. And yes, there is a horror movie in my worst movies of 2014 list, which I'm so excited to talk about, because I love talking about this movie. But the movie that I'm going to pick in for my top 10 2014 movies is a movie called Annabelle. Now, I really, really liked Annabelle. Yes, it got super cliche towards the end, but guys, this movie is amazing. The first 20 minutes alone are enough for me to give this in my for me to put this in my top 10. Annabelle pretty much focuses on these two couple who experience a traumatic incident, you know, when they're younger, and they move and start to be, you know, experience a haunting via demonic possession of this doll. Now, Annabelle is a prequel to the 2012 horror film The Conjuring, which was an amazing horror film, and yet it wasn't really anything special in terms of the plot, but based on a true story, and it was just done so well. And Annabelle is no different. The use of silence in both The Conjuring and Annabelle is just so effective. And, you know, the acting was shoddy. It was a typical horror movie, but I honestly think this is the best horror movie of the year. And if you guys get a chance, go see it. That doll is creepy as F, and I honestly can't recommend this movie enough for anybody who likes horror movies. The ending is quite cliched, so don't really have high hopes for it, but honestly, I think that you guys will really love it if you like horror movies. Okay, the final movie that I'm going to put for my favorites of 2014, and, you know, guys, I haven't actually seen all of the movies that I wanted to see, and so at the end of this, I'm going to give you a list of movies that I still want to see. In fact, I'm going to see before the end of the year, and, you know, hopefully we can talk about them more. But the last movie that I want to talk about is the movie Interstellar, which is Christopher Nolan's newest cinematic masterpiece. I can't give good enough reviews for this movie. If you like sci-fi, if you like adventure, if you like action, then you will love Interstellar. I absolutely adore this movie, and I've seen it twice now, and honestly, I think that it's absolutely amazing. Like, I can't talk it up enough. Interstellar follows a whole heap of random crazy things, but it mainly focuses on the character, a character played by Matthew McConaughey, who is an ex, I think, pilot for NASA, who ends up being sent to into space to find a new planet because the Earth is dying due to global warming. Interstellar is set in an undisclosed future that is a little bit dystopic, not Hunger Games dystopic, but, you know, it's getting there. But look, Interstellar is amazing. It's about 3 hours or so, so it's an epic, but, you know, it's got about three acts in it, and it has amazing, amazing acting. It's got fantastic directing. The special effects are insane, and Hans Zimmer's score for this movie is out of this world, literally. And so I would definitely recommend this movie. It was one of the movies that I gave one of the highest marks. I think I gave it a 4.9 out of 5. And I'd stand by that rating to this date after having seen the movie twice. So guys, definitely go out and see Interstellar, because I really love that movie. And yeah, that's all for my top 10 for 2014. Now to my bottom. I don't have 10 movies because I couldn't think of 10 movies that I hated. But, you know, I'm going to give you what I have is 6 movies of 2014 that I really, really disliked. Okay, so I'll start off with a movie that I disliked the least out of all of these. And these aren't really in any specific order apart from this. And that's Anchorman 2. Now, I loved Anchorman. Like, I love this movie. I love Anchorman. And yeah, I liked Anchorman 2, but my God, this was one of the stupidest movies I've ever seen. And yes, okay, I get that it's supposed to be stupid, but I really, really wish that it had been better. Like, I really like Anchorman 2. I want to preface that. But at the same time, I think that it needs to go on this list. Like, it really needs to go on this list. The acting was, like, really shocking. The script was really shocking. The directing was really shocking. There's a moment where one of the characters punches the shark. So I think that, you know, Anchorman may have literally jumped the shark here. Okay, so the next movie that I put in my worst films of 2014 is the movie Godzilla, because my god, Godzilla was not great. We reviewed this in an earlier podcast, which I think we have taken down from our site because of storage issues. You know, our hosting site can only host a specific amount of podcasts at a time, and these episodes get quite long and it's hard to keep the episodes up there. So, side note, if anybody ever wants an archived episode, send us an email at thefiction.fix@gmail.com and we can send you the episode manually. But yeah, so Godzilla was one of those movies that was interesting, but at the same time, it just had so much potential, but it just never reached it. Bryan Cranston's performance in the first half of the movie is absolutely amazing, and I think that this movie could have definitely been in my top 10 if Bryan Cranston had stayed on as the main character. But unfortunately, and spoiler alert here a little bit, unfortunately, Bryan Cranston doesn't stay on, and he passes the reins to the role of his son, played by Aaron Johnson, of Kick-Ass fame. Now, I love Kick-Ass, and Aaron Johnson is not an untalented actor, but his portrayal in this movie was definitely lacking. Definitely lacking. It was not great. His character was unrelatable, stiff, had such terrible dialogue, and it really didn't go anywhere. And yeah, as a Godzilla fan, I was excited to see Mothra, and I was excited to see a whole heap of things from this movie, but honestly, but at the end of the day, it just didn't do it for me. There was not enough in there. There was no suspense. I felt nothing for the characters, and that way, you know, there was no catharsis at the end. And I think that it's really important for an action movie, an adventure movie like this, to have that, you know, building up and release of suspense. And it just didn't do it for me. So I think Godzilla's got to go in my worst movies of this year. Another movie this year that I really hated was Spider-Man 2. And anybody who knows me knows that I'm a massive Spider-Man fan, and I love Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone as Gwen and Peter Parker. And I think Andrew Garfield is probably the best Spider-Man that we've had. You know, Tobey Maguire ain't got nothing on Andrew Garfield. But this movie was just not good. The directing was bad, the dialogue was terrible, and the only redeeming feature for the movie was the love scenes between Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield, because that chemistry was 100% real, because they're dating in real life. Spider-Man 2, I had high hopes because I knew what was going to happen at the end, and there's a good twist at the end, but it was just over the top, overdone, overrated, and I think that this movie really brought a bad name to the Spider-Man franchise. The Amazing Spider-Man, the first movie of the series that came out in either 2011 or 2012, was amazing, and it gave me such, you know, renewed relief that this was going to be in good hands. But, you know, Spider-Man 2 was not great, and I'm really hoping that they can salvage it when they do Sinister Six. The next movie I'm going to talk about is the movie Deliver Us From Evil, and that's the horror movie of my bottom list for 2014. Deliver Us From Evil is a horror movie starring Eric Banner, you know, our Australian golden child, as a cop who gets involved in a whole heap of supernatural possession random stuff. The movie stars Olivia Munn as well, and I love Olivia Munn. Anybody who knows me knows I love The Newsroom. But I think that this movie was so over the top. It's ridiculous. Like, I don't think I can convey how over the top this movie was. It's so ridiculous. And yeah, I know that horror movies are supposed to be over the top, and they're supposed to be, like, crazy and ridiculous, but, like, let's be honest, when you get to this level of ridiculousness, I just can't deal. Like, I just can't deal. And, like, there was, one of the characters is a priest who was Spanish, but also was a former cocaine addict, and one of the storylines was the fact that he got a girl pregnant before he became a priest. I'm like, I don't understand how people can make these movies. Anyway, so I won't harp on about it. You can definitely hear it in another of our podcasts. And I definitely went on a rant about how great this movie was because it was so shit. So definitely go check that out. Deliver Us From Evil. The next movie I'm going to talk about is the movie Bad Neighbors, starring Zac Efron and Seth Rogen. Now, what can I say about this movie? The movie's one redeeming feature was the fact that Dave Franco and Zac Efron's bromance in this movie was the most adorable thing in the world. And the fact that, yeah, Zac Efron is very pretty when he's not wearing, like, the top layer of clothes. But also, not as much when Seth Rogen is also doing exactly the same thing. The humor in this movie is very teenage boy humor. It's the type of humor that you would find in a Will Ferrell movie. And sometimes that works, but it was Seth Rogen's particular brand of humor that people will know from movies like Pineapple Express and movies like The Interview that just came out recently. And I think that Seth Rogen's particular brand of humor doesn't appeal to me at all. It's very crude, it's very over the top, and sometimes over the top is good, but other times over the top is just the worst thing that you can do. So I've got to say that Bad Neighbors is bad, and it makes, you know, my worst list of 2014. Having said that, I haven't seen that many movies that I really hated, and I don't think I hated Bad Neighbors. I just strongly disliked it. Okay, so there's only one movie left in my list of worst movies of 2014, and I think that it's a movie that deserves it, because, my God, this was a bad movie. It was a bad movie. No swearing. Bad movie. And that's the movie Tammy. Now, I like Melissa McCarthy. The Heat is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I'm currently watching the show Gilmore Girls that she's in, playing one of the main characters, and she's so great in that. She's so adorable and lovely, but my God, she was so terrible in Tammy. I don't understand who came up with this idea. Tammy had such an amazing cast, and it was going to be a movie about female empowerment. Sandra Oh, Kathy Bates, Susan Sarandon, Allison Janney, Toni Collette, and Melissa McCarthy. And all of these actresses, these talented, talented women of film, were in this movie, and I just feel so, that they were just degraded. Like, Kathy Bates, had an Oscar-nominated, did she win Best Actress for Misery? She was insanely good in Misery, and then all of a sudden she's doing Tammy, where she plays, I don't know how to describe her character, almost stereotypical lesbian, and I don't know how to describe it, really. Yeah, it was not great. The acting was terrible, the dialogue was terrible. So Tammy just about rounds off my least favorite movies of 2014. The last thing that I'm going to do before I sign off for the year, before we see you guys in 2015, is give you a list of movies that I still really want to watch. And I'm probably going to end up watching them, hopefully, before the 31st. I mean, that's, my goal. I don't know how accurate it is or how it's going to happen. But these are the movies that I really, really still want to watch. I want to watch a movie called The One I Love, which stars Elizabeth Moss from Mad Men, in a weird, kind of quirky, romantic film. The movie St. Vincent is the next movie I want to see, starring Melissa McCarthy and Bill Murray. I also want to see Zach Braff's new film, Wish I Was Here. Garden State is one of my favorite movies, and I'm really hoping Wish I Was Here is the same. I want to see the horror movie Ouija. I want to see the movie Horns with Daniel Radcliffe, which is based on a best-selling book, which I am also really eager to read. Daniel Radcliffe has had, a really interesting time moving on from Harry Potter, and so I think that it'll be really interesting to see him play this, devil incarnate character. I need to see Nightcrawler. I'm going to go see it. I absolutely have to go see this. Ben would not stop raving about it, and I think that it's going to be amazing. Jake Gyllenhaal is one of the most talented actors that I've seen, and I think that he can really do this movie justice. I want to see Big Hero 6, which has just come out in the cinemas. I'm a massive fan of Disney movies, and I think that this movie is going to be no different. I've heard amazing things about it. I also want to see The Theory of Everything, which is a biopic about Stephen Hawking. It's got nominated for a Golden Globe, and it's barely been out. I don't even know if it's been released in Australia yet. And then the last movie I want to see is Benedict Cumberbatch's new movie, The Imitation Game. That movie looks amazing. I've always been interested in Alan Turing. And it'll be interesting to see Keira Knightley in a new movie, because I haven't really seen her in anything since Pirates of the Caribbean. But apart from that, that's pretty much it from me for 2014. I have really, really enjoyed making this podcast, and I know that I'm going to enjoy making it next year as well. Thank you guys so much for listening and for subscribing to us and for making us feel like we're actually doing something that people like. If you do like this podcast, make sure to give us a whole heap of feedback, because we've been doing it for a year now, and this is something that gives us a lot of joy and it makes us really happy to do. So, yeah, thank you guys for an amazing year, and I'm really looking forward to giving you more movie gossip and movie news for 2015. Rohan out.
All right, and we are back. Really interesting. I find that there are a lot of similarities and a few differences that really kind of showcase how individual these lists are and why they are entirely opinionated, and it's okay to have your own opinion. I think we'll start off with my personal top 10 stinkers of 2014. Starting off with number 10, I, Frankenstein. I'm not going to dwell too much on I, Frankenstein, purely because there was not much that went on in that movie. I mean, you had Aaron Eckhart, who has, you know, got a great rapport in film. I mean, he was in Dark Knight, it is incredible. But I really feel like in this film, he was just really eye candy for a plot that was going nowhere. Well, they tried to do a lot with the movie, but just, it was a mess, you know? There's not much that you could really take from it that was profound in any way. And it's just not a movie that I really enjoyed. Number 9 was a movie that is going to be controversial when I announce it, but my number 9 worst film of 2014 is Anchorman 2. Now, don't get me wrong. I was a big fan of Anchorman 1, right? The humor was incredible. Will Ferrell was funny as... probably my second favorite Will Ferrell film, next to Elf, naturally. But I just feel like Anchorman 2 lost the plot. There is a saying which is jumping the shark, and it's weird because there are actually sharks in here that, when in the context of the plot, really satisfy that idiom, because sharks and this weird battle at the end with Harrison Ford and Liam Neeson, I don't understand where it all came from, and it doesn't make sense to me. And the whole franchise has basically killed itself with Anchorman 2. I mean, yes, there were some beauties. There were some wonderful one-liners in there. Josh Lawson was phenomenal, and I can't remember the guy's name, but Cyclops from X-Men was also pretty funny, but I just feel like it didn't have the same charm as the first one, and maybe it's because we had too high expectations, but Anchorman 2... for the moment, is number 9 on my list. Number 8 is a movie that I saw with other kids, and they really enjoyed it, but I was not a big fan. Rio 2 was number 8 on my top 10 stinkers of 2014. I just feel like a plot like that, with characters that are shallow and predictable, I understand it's a kids' film and they may enjoy it, but I just personally, I did not appreciate the plot. I didn't really like what was going on, clearly, because it's on my top 10 worst list, but it just didn't mesh well with me. Or maybe it's just because I have a higher standard for film and I'm an adult and I want some complexity to it, but even for kids, I don't understand why they would like it. I mean, there were kids that I went with that didn't really like it, that preferred the first one, and I completely understand why. The first one was a little bit better, but this second one, man, was it bad. Number 7 was a film that I had high hopes for. It had a great cast. It had Johnny Depp, Morgan Freeman. It had a plot that sounded great on paper. When I read the synopsis, reading about this guy who died and put his mind into a computer and the internet and took over things, it sounded like it could be phenomenal and really profound statements on humanity and life in general. But when you watched it, oh my God, it was boring. Transcendence is number 7 on my list, purely because it was boring as shit. Really, just, I don't understand how they could have such an incredible plot and have Paul Bettany and Johnny Depp and whatnot, and just really destroy a plot that had so much potential. The pacing was so off, and the acting... Look, these actors are incredible. Just in this film, they were not great at all. And Transcendence, really, really, probably one of the worst films of the year, and well deserving of number 7. Now, number 6 and 5, I won't spend too much time on, purely because they are of the same genre. And this genre is, as we have highlighted in, I think, episode 8, it has got lots of flaws. And these two films are epitomes of the flaws of the horror genre. And number 6 is Deliver Us From Evil with Eric Bana. And number 5 is Ouija. Oh my God, these films are rubbish. I already expressed my distaste for horror films in general and how I'm not a big fan of them. However, I saw these films purely because my friends told me that they were not scary in any way and that they were just funny to watch because they were so bad. And they were not wrong. Ouija especially was just a poorly executed film. Everything that happened was repetitive and was predictable and was cringeworthy. The acting was piss poor, and the plot was apparently based off the actual board game Ouija, and I don't understand why you would do that. Clearly, the fruits of their labor have shown themselves to be rotten in this film, Ouija, because it didn't get good reviews, and it was personally just one of my least enjoyable films of 2014. We're getting to the top 4 now, and the top 4 you can really move around anywhere based on your own personal thoughts. And I had a bit of trouble with the top 4, top 5 actually. Ouija I had a bit higher earlier on, but then I saw a couple of movies that just really, really just downgraded the entire list for me and had to push Ouija a little further down the list. Number 4 was a film that came out way earlier in the year, which was Legend of Hercules. This film was just, oh my God, the acting was awful. I saw this one scene where the guy gets attacked by a spear and he shoves it under his arm. It was something comical, something out of Benny Hill, you know, it's acting on a scale that I rarely see, you know, and it's a plot and the sets and the costumes were something out of year two drama production. And it's just, I can't understand why this film was given the go-ahead, you know, given the green light. Especially after seeing how crap it is. I saw The Rock's Hercules much later on, and it just really stood up almost as a masterpiece in comparison to Legend of Hercules. Now, number three was a film that we reviewed a couple of episodes ago, featuring Melissa McCarthy really relying on her sense of humor, but kind of undermining it in a way by giving her a character that was not relatable in the slightest, and that was Tammy. Now, there are road trips that are done well. Due Date, for example, done well. However, when you have a road trip film with a kind of mother-daughter relationship, grandmother-daughter, whatever relationship, that is awkward and the dialogue is shocking and just the characters are not relatable, they're not understandable, the comedy just falls flat, and it's a film that you don't enjoy and that just gets worse over time as you think about it. And I did have that higher on the list until the next day I saw Transformers Age of Extinction, which is number two on my list. Just this explosion of Michael Bay's ego on the screen with, you know, fireworks and flames and this mass of metal orgy just in your face all the time. It's without plot and you think it's going to end here, but it keeps going and going and going. And you find yourself in one place, not knowing how you got there. And then all of a sudden, in the next scene, you're in another place with characters that you don't care about, with lines that don't fit well with the context nor with their characters. And it's just a film that was a mess, and it's really, really well deserving of number two, because I really hope that they don't make another Transformers film. And if they do, get rid of Michael Bay, because this film epitomizes exactly why we dislike Michael Bay and why we dislike his style. He can do films well, but Transformers Age of Extinction really showcases his ego on a grand scale, and it's disappointing. However, number one was a film that I mentioned briefly in one episode, if you caught it, and that is Earth to Echo. Earth to Echo was just, oh my god, what do I say about this film? It's about a group of kids who find an alien and take him home, whatnot. I don't even understand this film. The acting by the kids was so, so pathetic. It was, I don't understand. The plot itself was cliched as hell. The graphics were disgustingly poor. The directing was rubbish, which really concerns me, because the director of Earth to Echo is in talks to be the director of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. And that horrifies me. It makes me dread what they're going to do when they destroy and distort what is my personal, one of my favorite franchises. And Earth to Echo itself is an awful time. And please do not buy this film. Do not see this film. Do not ever talk to anyone about this film, because it is traumatizing. And that, my friends, is my top 10 worst films of 2014. I hope you guys have some opinions on that. I mean, I feel like there are some bottom 10 films of 2014. I feel like you can switch in and out films a bit more easily than you can with the top 10. There's a bit more pressure for the top 10, which is why I'm a little nervous in letting you guys know what my favorite films of 2014 were, especially since I haven't seen all of them, and, you know, I don't think anyone's seen all the films of 2014, so everyone's going to have different opinions. And I'm disappointed as well with the Australian release dates, as I've said earlier, with Birdman, Imitation Game, Theory of Everything, and American Sniper not having come out yet, and I have really high expectations for those, acting-wise, directorially. I'm really looking forward to them, but I'm disappointed that they're not out yet, so I couldn't put them on this list. And I'm also disappointed in myself. I didn't see Whiplash when it was out, and then I'm going to have to wait until it comes out on DVD before I let you guys know what I think. But at the moment, of the films that I've seen, my top 10 best films of 2014 are, at number 10, we have a film where Tom Hardy is in a car. That is the entire description of the film, and yet it still sits at number 10 on my list, and that is Locke. The reason why I put Locke at number 10, and why I made the list at all, is because of Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy's acting in the film is absolutely outstanding. He plays a Welsh guy. He's going through some family troubles, going through some work troubles, and he's sitting in a car, driving, and talking on his phone to different people as he goes from, I think, from one place to another, to a hospital, I think. And the entire film is just him in the car, but the acting and the dialogue is absolutely brilliant. And Tom Hardy himself was just incredible to watch, to see the complexities of his character just in his conversations with people on the phone really showcase his ability as an actor. And I had a lot of fun with this film. Yes, it's boring. Yes, it's artsy for some people. But I thought that it had a lot of depth to it, and I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed every single line that he had, every single minute of that film. Number nine was a real curveball this year. I wasn't sure how the film would actually turn out, but it had a lot of hype, and it did very well at the box office, and that was Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy. I had a heap of fun with this film, and that's the reason why I put it in the list, is because the plot wasn't all that great. The characters weren't all that well established, especially the villains. But it was just a lot of fun in this film. The action and the comedy was just really well done, really well timed, and really, really well delivered by the actors, especially Bradley Cooper and Chris Pratt. Chris Pratt, my God, just I applaud him for everything he's done this year. It's just. Yes, applause. Just play that applause sound there. Chris Pratt, really phenomenal job, and I'm really excited to see what he's going to do in Jurassic World and what he's going to do beyond that. And Guardians of the Galaxy sits at number 9 on my list. Number 8 was a film that I had high expectations for, and they met them with a whole load of explosions and blood and really complex characters, and that was Fury. Brad Pitt and Logan Lerman really, really impressed me, as did Shia LaBeouf, actually. The actors are incredible, and a lot of people gave this film criticism for having characters that weren't relatable or weren't likable in the end of the film, but I personally disagree. I found a lot of little subtleties in the characters that I found likable and I found brought this film home for me and really provided catharsis at the end of the film when there was a whole lot of conflict. And it was a film that I had a lot of fun with. I keep saying that. I don't know why I keep saying that. It was really well done, and the lights and the cinematography was really well executed, and the sound as well was very commendable in a way. Number 7 was a film that a lot of people were asking for many years. I mean, if you had have asked 20 years ago when Groundhog Day came out, if you had have asked, hey, can we make an action film of this? People would have thought that you were crazy. People would have thought, what are you talking about? Like, action film of Groundhog Day? Are you insane? Bill Murray couldn't play that. And no, Bill Murray couldn't play that. But you know who did play that well? Tom Cruise. And I'm talking about Edge of Tomorrow. It was a film that sounded fantastic on paper, but there were a lot of doubts and suspicions going around about the film when before it was released, thinking, could it actually work? Is Tom Cruise really still an action star? And the thing is, Tom Cruise in this film wasn't an action star. He was just an everyday PR soldier who'd never seen the battlefield, and all of a sudden is placed in the depths of this warfare and battle and sees all this devastation and wreckage. The film is just a really well-done film. The action was really good. Tom Cruise was excellent. Emily Blunt was excellent. And the storyline itself was so intriguing. And it was one that I've been thinking about for years. But finally, they put it on screen. And yeah, there's this real satisfaction there whenever anything happens in that film. Every time he goes back. And it's not just once or twice. It's a lot of times that he goes back and restarts the day. And it's just a fun that I found super, super enjoyable. And if they made a second one, or if they made a spin-off or whatever, I would see that movie in a heartbeat. Number 6 was a film that I thought would go in one direction and would be a little bit predictable, but it turned and went down routes that I wasn't expecting, and that really made the film an incredible viewing experience for me, and that is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. The acting by Andy Serkis and Jason Clarke and Gary Oldman even, it's really, really well done. And the animation especially on the apes. And the plot was something that thought would go down one alley but then went down another, and a whole load of different subsidiary avenues after that. And it's a fun experience that you go into expecting one thing and coming out thinking an entirely different thing. And absolutely 100% recommended. And if they make a third one, I really hope that they keep the same themes going, that they keep the same director or writer on board, whatever made that film work, so that we can just have this excellent trilogy there of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and the third one, because at the moment they've got a good thing going, and I really hope they can keep that up. Now we're hitting the top 5, and same with my top 5 in my least favorite films, the top 5 of my favorite films could really be interswapped. However, number 5 was a little bit separate from the pack, and that was Gone Girl. Gone Girl was just a really complex movie, and it was fascinating watching these characters have these relationships and watch them go through these different ambiguous twists and turns that you're not sure where it's all going to go, and you're trying to follow the plot along with Ben Affleck, and you're following him, you're seeing him react to everything, and this intensity there, and you're trying to work everything out with him, so you're going along for the ride, and it's writing and directing that is done very, very well. And it's something that you rarely see. And it's something that was done really well in Prisoners, and that's what made Prisoners a really good film and one of my favorite films of 2013. And that's what made Gone Girl a super, super good film. And that's probably what I would liken it to. Gone Girl is the Prisoners of 2014. And it's very, very well written. The dialogue is excellent. And it just takes the audience along for the ride. And it's just a very enjoyable and challenging experience as a viewer and as a person who, and for me personally as a writer, to see these twists and turns and to think in my head, oh my gosh, I don't know which way it's going, but I'm just really, really having a good time with it. The top four, as I said just previously, were separate from Gone Girl, but I had a bit of trouble in figuring out where to put these next two. Number four and three, I wasn't sure where I was going to put them, but in the end, they were both comic book movies. As you would expect, yes, number four is Captain America Winter Soldier. Now, coming into this film, I had low expectations. I wasn't a really big fan of the first Avenger, Captain America, the first Captain America movie, and so I wasn't really sure where this movie was going to go, especially because Captain America was not as well done as the other Avengers characters. But really, in this film, they show that superhero films and Marvel films can also be great spy and espionage films, and that they have this complexity and depth to them, as well as action and no need for romance, obviously, because ain't nobody got time for that. But it's just a really, really well done film, and it's a comic book film that really will stand the test of time. And I mean, this along with number three on my list, they are some of the best comic book films I have ever seen. Captain America Winter Soldier especially is definitely my top three favorite Marvel films of all time, and I just had a lot of fun with it. And now Captain America is one of my favorite Avengers. Who would have guessed it? This film was unexpectedly awesome. However, you cannot beat number three. Number three is a film that I also didn't have very high expectations for, purely because they didn't have a great route or a great lead-up with previous films, and that is X-Men Days of Future Past. Now, I had seen X3, I'd seen X-Men Origins Wolverine, and they were just really, really awful films. But then I saw Wolverine, and I saw X-Men First Class, and I started to get a bit more hope. And then I found out that Bryan Singer, the director of the first two X-Men films, was coming back on board to direct X-Men Days of Future Past, and that got me really excited, although I was still very apprehensive how the old director was going to come into this new shamble of a franchise and kind of piece it all together. And he does it phenomenally in a way that I wasn't expecting, because no one else could wipe away everything that has happened apart from one or two films and start off with a clean slate going forward with this new era of X-Men, other than Bryan Singer. And it was done very, very well. And he addresses the characters, he addresses the plot with a great admiration and with great respect. And I appreciate that sort of directing style. And the acting was great, the characters were great, the storyline itself was brilliant. And it was just a really enjoyable movie to sit down and to watch these mutants that we've come to know and love that have been treated so poorly in the past, but all of a sudden are now treated really well and are given so much depth, especially James McAvoy's Charles Xavier, just to see the depth of his character and the dimensions. It was really an enjoyable experience and 100% deserves to be in my top three. Now, number two was a film that I saw a couple of weeks ago, saw it about a few days after it came out, and it's something that blew my mind when I saw it. Again, didn't have very high expectations for it, but in a similar way to Prisoners, and features the same actor as was in Prisoners, it had this complexity to the main character and to the characters as a whole that just really made this film. And the dialogue itself, similar to Prisoners, was just something that was mind-boggling to watch. It was funny, but at the same time, it was twisted and weird and really showcased the depths of the main character. And that is Nightcrawler. Jake Gyllenhaal, I don't know where he was in the film, but I saw this creepy dude smashing mirrors and twisting people and manipulating them and talking a whole lot of business jargon in human relations that just didn't make sense, but it's done so well. And if this film isn't nominated for Best Original Screenplay, I don't know what should, because the writing in this film and the acting in this film was absolutely outstanding. Jake Gyllenhaal, I believe, deserves Best Actor in the Golden Globes because he is nominated. I don't know whether he'll get it. The script obviously wasn't nominated for Best Screenplay, which I'm very disappointed with, but I think Jake Gyllenhaal absolutely deserves Best Actor. His work in this film is insanely good. It's just, it's something that you can, that you rarely see nowadays. He just adds so many dimensions to the character. His, the subtleties of, you know, flicks of the eyelid to twitches of the mouth and slicking his hair back and everything he does is just phenomenal and outstanding. That's something that will stick with me for a very long time. Now, number one. This is highly anticipated. I've been asked by so many people, hey, what do you think the best film of 2014 is? And I'm like, well, you know, you're going to have to wait till the podcast. But at the moment, I'm not sure because there are so many great films. And this film was one that has had very mixed reviews. And a lot of people are going to be very annoyed with me for having this as number one. But I personally enjoy this film to every single second of it. Yes, there were a few flaws in it, but nothing that took away from just how much I enjoyed it. And Christopher Nolan is my favorite director of all time. You can really trust him to bring a great film to life. And his ambition in this film was really something that tested a lot of critics' trust in him. However, I personally believe that Interstellar was done incredibly well. The effects were insanely good. The music was just out of this world, no pun intended. And if Hans Zimmer and the effects team and the sound team don't win Oscars for this film, then I'm supremely disappointed in the Academy for that. Because Interstellar was just something that will stick with me for a very, very long time. It's kind of like The Dark Knight and Inception in that way, in that there's so much going on. The gravitas of everything that's happening is just so impactful on me as a person and on humanity as a whole. While some people may think that it's just a pit stop film, I would have to respectfully disagree in that there is so many layers to this film that a pit stop film is just it's way too oversimplifying it. And Matthew McConaughey and Hathaway as actors were insanely good. Jessica Chastain was really good. And the girl who played Murph, don't know what her name is, but she has got a bright future ahead of her. She is really, really good. It took twists and turns that were half predictable, but then half just out of nowhere that you didn't expect, but works so well in the plot. And it's just something that will resonate with me and with audiences for a very long time. And Rohan and Martin obviously agree with me that this is one of the best films of 2014. And if you don't have it as your number one, at least you can appreciate that it was a good film. It wasn't a bad film, but that's what a lot of critics are saying. They're saying it's bad because it didn't live up to their expectations, but it's not a bad film. It's really, really good. And just because it didn't live up to their expectations, they're all of a sudden calling it a bad film. It's not. I personally had mixed expectations for it. High expectations because it's Christopher Nolan, low expectations because of the critics' reviews. And so coming in with like an objective standpoint, I thought it was a phenomenal film and absolutely deserves number one. Well, that's it, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in to our final podcast episode for 2014. It has been an incredible year. Rohan and Martin and I, we conceived the idea of having a podcast late in 2013, and we released the first episode, I think, end of January, beginning of February in 2014, and really, this has been a roller coaster ride. So thank you so much to all of you guys for sticking with us, for being with us every step of the way. 2015 is going to be a massive year. We're going to still be around. Thank you to Toussaint Morrison for all his kind work in letting us use his music, his phenomenal mixture of reggae with hip-hop. It's insane. But mostly, of course, thank you to you guys for listening, for tuning in, for sharing us with your friends, for liking our Facebook page, for following us on Tumblr, following me on Instagram, following Rohan on Twitter. It's just really been one hell of a ride. But 2015, we've got a big year ahead of us. Maybe there'll be changes. Maybe there'll be evolutions to our podcast. Who knows what the future holds for us. But we're going to be here for you guys, bringing you reviews, bringing you guys information and news on film and on TV. And let's make 2015 even bigger than 2014. So thank you very much, guys. Thank you for the ride. Still be here in 2015. Hope you had fun with this podcast. Hope you have a great new year. And until next time, we'll make your podcast you can't refuse.
Her mood switched like a profile pic. Cut me out till it looks like this. But I was with the ex, getting good night sex. She was standing at the ledge, singing, come fly with.
The second film that we're going to talk about, Peter Jackson's highly anticipated film, the final of part... The second film that I'm going to talk about today is Peter Jackson's final installment of the whole... Far out. There's going to be a lot of these blunders today, unfortunately. Being on your own means that you don't have someone else to bounce back and forth with, and I guess in an area like this, in a small booth, without natural lighting, without windows, without aircon, because it creates noise, you got to have the light on, you got, you know, an enclosed area with no ventilation, it gets really, really hot, especially around this time of year, so excuse me if I just, if you hear some slicking back of hair covered in sweat, because it's absolutely steaming hot in here. So I'll be back very soon, but in the meantime, go grab a drink or whatever, go, you know, talk to that chick across the bus, whatever. I don't even know what I'm talking about at this point. I'm just talking to myself. It's kind of awkward talking to a microphone by yourself. It's really kind of strange doing a podcast by yourself in a room where you're sweating like a pig because there's no air conditioning, because it makes noises. There are no natural lights. I suppose, actually, no, there is an upside to recording by yourself, and it's that I've taken the liberty of wearing the daggiest clothes that I have in my wardrobe because no one cares. I usually get a little bit dressed up, at least, to record. But at the moment, I'm the only one here, so it doesn't really matter what I wear or what I look like, because my hair is a mess. But it is what it is. Rohan and Martin will be back very soon for 2015. It's going to be a big year. Just this explosion of Michael Gate.
Oh, God. No, that is maturity. After the break, you can't have your cake and I get ate up. Sex after the break up. You can't have your cake and I get ate up. True sex after the break up. You can't have your cake and I get ate up. Alright, sex after the break up. She wanna bring the heat, so I'm calling Bobby Drake up. I dance dirty, but don't get the hands dirty. We're past flirting, I'm at first, but not third yet. I can't turn it off, I'm that certain. Gave her the tremendous 12, and we ain't even at Perkins. I'm ass murder and heartbreak, I'm at your service. I talk for a living, I was raised by last worders. Table turners, but real talk, no play. If you going in, make sure you make a say. I made a say.